Construction meets the world's most popular board game in new Monopoly Construction Edition. Amass or possibly lose great fortunes. Every space on the board is packed with both iconic construction brands and incredible infrastructure projects in this new exciting edition of Monopoly. You'll need to make smart decisions to come out on top. Have you got what it takes to succeed in the world of construction? Search Construction Monopoly to order now.
Well, welcome to another episode of Reconstruction with me, David Taylor from the Construction Index magazine, and Phil Bishop, editor of our daily online news service. Good morning, Phil.
Morning, David.
I didn't say, but listeners might be interested to know that we are recording on August the 4th, Wednesday the 4th of August. What do you know what happened 107 years ago today, Phil?
Ooh, 107, that would be, what are we talking about, 19... did the war start?
The Great War, yes, indeed. I just happened to know that, August the 4th, so there we are.
Blimey.
Anyway, we're not going to talk about war, at least I hope we're not going to talk about war today. We're going to talk about construction, transport, technology, that kind of thing. Big story of the week, Phil, tell us what it is.
Well, as I mentioned last week, I've been away all week and been out of the news cycle, but I did see and was surprised to see that the Stonehenge Tunnel project has been blocked by the courts. A legal challenge against it has been upheld by Justice Holgate. And there's a lot to talk about, I think, with regard to this.
Yeah, I was very surprised. I mean, I thought, I still don't fully understand what people's objections are to this scheme. The one thing I can sort of deduce, well, not deduce, but one thing I can put my finger on, and isn't, in fact, it's a point made by objectors, which I actually agree with, is that the tunnel isn't long enough. They think it should be, is it 1.4 kilometres long instead of whatever it is, 1 kilometre. I think 4.5 kilometres instead of 4 kilometres. And I think that is good, but I wouldn't have thought that was grounds to actually put the kibosh on the whole scheme. There must be more to it.
The scheme is what it is. I don't think the judge has got the power to say the job can go ahead if they, you know, make it not cut and cover, but bored all the way through or make it longer. It's just, this is what's in front of them. And the judge has said, no, you can't do that. What it seems to be, I haven't read the whole judgment, but I've been reading the reports, trying to rapidly catch up this morning with what's going on. I mean, there's a lot of ammunition for the opponents to the scheme in the planning inspector's report. If you remember, we talked about this.
Yes.
I think it was last November, was it, when we discussed Stonehenge Tunnel last? The planning inspectors, you could sort of take your pick from the various things that the planning inspector said, and that they said there would be substantial harm to the significance of the World Heritage Site. But they also said there would be cultural heritage benefits. But the bottom line was they came out saying that the adverse impacts strongly outweigh its benefits, and therefore the inspectors reached the conclusion that development planning consent should not be granted. Grant Shapps basically said, bugger you, I'm doing it, and granted consent to the scheme, and last November said, yep, go ahead, start building. The fact that he went against the report, I suppose, left open a large door for a legal challenge to walk through. And that's been upheld. What happens now, though, is wait and see. It's not up to High... I mean, Highways England have expressed disappointment, so we're confident that the scheme we've put forward is still the best and the right one. And it's up to the Department for Transport, as Highways England's client, to say whether they want to do anything. If you remember, earlier this year, the Heathrow Airport expansion was thrown out. There was a legal challenge to that, the plan for the third runway at Heathrow. And the court said, nope, that is in breach of the Paris Climate Change Agreement and our UK commitments to that. And therefore, you can't do that. And the Department of Transport said, nothing to do with us, Gov, that's a private sector scheme. And they decided, resolutely sat on their hands, sat back and said, we're just an interested observer. But Stonehenge Tunnel, Highways England, not private sector. It is a Department of Transport project, ultimately. And whether they just decide to sit back and say, oh, well, that's a £1.7 billion we can avoid spending, or whether they come back, we have to wait and see.
I mean, does that Paris Agreement argument apply to the Stonehenge Tunnel as well? Because, I mean, the Heathrow expansion has clear impact on sort of carbon emissions, the fact that you're expanding a massive airport and you're going to have far more planes flying in and out. There's a clear conflict between that and our commitment to reduce our carbon emissions. But the Stonehenge Tunnel isn't actually... At least, I mean, I think it'd be hard to argue that it's actually going to increase the amount of traffic passing along the A303 past that site.
No, I think the argument for Stonehenge was the World Heritage asset under threat. That kind of argument, even though it was the tunnel is 50 metres underground and 400 metres away, it's still.
I find this really puzzling, actually, because I think there were 10 objections raised in the High Court, which this judge had to consider, and he rejected it on two of those, eight of them he didn't agree with, but two of them he did. One of which was that Grant Shapps, as Secretary of State, was legally obliged to consider other options, one of which was extending the length of the tunnel. But another one was the option to build a cut-and-cover tunnel rather than a twin-board tunnel. And I would have thought there's absolutely no question that a board tunnel would be better.
No, you're misunderstanding. There's the twin-board tunnel, but there's also a large cutting.
Right.
And some of the protesters are arguing there should be a lid on the cutting.
Oh, I see. Right. You're right. I didn't misunderstand that. I thought they were saying that the bore tunnel should be a cut and cover job. Right. Okay. Well, that changes the complexion slightly, I suppose. But
your point about the carbon impact of the tunnel, actually, I would argue, without any great expertise or science knowledge, but it seems to me logical that smoothly moving traffic is less polluting than the stop-start traffic jams which most motorists get stuck in when they drive past Stonehenge at the moment.
Yes, there's nearly always a tailback. I think it's just simply because people start rubbernecking as soon as they go past the stones.
And why wouldn't you?
And I've seen so many times I don't have to look at them, but I suppose if it's the first time you've seen them, oh, there's a World Heritage site, we better have a look.
Well, I'm always interested to see how many people are visiting it. I mean, it's not just to see the stones, it's to see, oh, you know, are there lots of crowds out today? Are there lots of tourists in town?
Well, yes, you can do that with a glance. You don't have to stop and stare at it, but it does slow the traffic down. You're absolutely right. The traffic going past the stones is always on a go slow, except on very rare occasions. Yeah, I agree that keeping the traffic running would be far better from the environmental point of view.
I think I've mentioned before what makes me slow down is not the stones, but a little further west of the pig farm.
The pigs.
Although they're further away from the road these days. But maybe we should put the pigs in a cut and cover so that we can't see them.
Oh, that'd be really cruel.
No, I don't mean it. I don't mean, I'm being facetious. Of course I don't want them in.
Of course.
beautiful creatures.
Subterranean pigs. No, I mean, I was surprised when I heard that this ruling had been made. But what does it mean for the project? Does it simply mean that Grant Shapps has to take into account the things that the judge pointed out and then say you can go ahead? I mean, presumably, once you've got this court ruling, that means that you can't go any further with it, surely?
My answer to that is I don't know, but I do think it's all going to be wrapped up with another recent development. And let's just go back a year or so. This whole argument of not the argument, the essentially Transport Action Network seems to be the biggest anti-roads action group in the game at the moment, and what they've been doing. And it was in March 2020 that they said that the government should review its national policy national policy statement for national networks in light of the net zero carbon commitments that the government have made. I mean, the strategic planning policy for road and rail schemes was written in 2014. And everything hinges on this. And this is before the government's legal commitment to net zero and before the Paris and all this, that and the other. I mean, the whole environmental, not just argument, but government policy has moved an awful long way in the past 7 years. And the planning framework that governs road and rail has not moved anywhere in 7 years. And it seems kind of weird that the government is saying yay or nay to roads on the basis of an out-of-date policy. It's a bit like, you know, planning roads on the basis of horse and cart, and then, you know, ignoring the fact that motor cars have been invented almost. So initially Shapp said, sort of prevaricated, said, no, I'm going to ignore that. And he went, first thing he did on after the Transport Action Network complaints, published the second road investment strategy, RIS2, which is sort of a £27 billion. It's not a £27 billion road building plan. It includes road maintenance and junction upgrades and pedestrian, including, you know, cycling and walking schemes and new green street lighting and all sorts of things. But it's about £14 billion worth of new road construction, I think, within there. And I think it's a 5 year or a 10 year thing? I think it's a 5 year thing.
Yes, I think it's 5 years.
So we're talking about, you know, £2 or 3 billion a year being spent on building roads, which in the wake of what's been spent in COVID doesn't seem like very much anymore. anyway, so Shapps has now done a U-turn on that, and last month he said, "Okay, yeah, we are going to review the roads program, we're going to review the national policy statement on national networks." He says it'll continue to remain in force for the time being, but he said it's right that we review it in the light of developments and update forecasts on which it is based, to reflect more recent post-pandemic conditions once they are known. So there's two things. One is traffic forecasts are likely to change, we don't know how, post-COVID, and we've now got our net zero commitments, which we didn't have 7 years ago.
Yeah.
So we have to, that has come about, I think, from pressure from action groups saying you're basing your transport planning on and transport policy on out-of-date policies.
Out-of-date stuff, yeah.
So we've got that. And then we were talking about the Stonehenge ruling. That came out on the 30th of July. But only 4 days earlier, 26th of July, the Transport Action Network's legal challenge against the road investment strategy, they had their day in court challenging that he hadn't taken into account Paris and net zero carbon commitments and so on. And that was thrown out. They lost that challenge. It was the courts decided that it was okay for the roads investment strategy to not take account of environmental commitments, and I guess because it was in line with the national planning statement, national policy statement on national networks.
Doesn't sound very joined up, does it?
Well, what I found particularly interesting, it's the same judge.
Oh, I didn't realise that.
The guy who said, Stonehenge, no, you can't build that, was the same man who said to the Department of Transport, your roads programme, that's fine, we have no problem with that. This is a guy called David Holgate. And so I tried to find something about Justice Holgate, and I couldn't really find out much about him. He's been president of the Upper Tribunal's Tribunal Lands Chamber since 2016. No idea what that is. And no planning idea. Liaison judge since 2017. And that's all I know. But it does seem his name crops up in quite a lot of, I don't know if he's been involved in fracking, but these sort of big planning political things, Justice Holgate's name tends to crop up. And all I managed to find out was where he went to school, somewhere in Loughton, and that he went to Oxford, and he turned 65 yesterday. Happy birthday, Justice Holgate.
Yeah.
Sorry we didn't get you anything. But I couldn't find out much else about him, which is probably a good thing, I think. I don't think we ought not know too much about our judge. We don't like celebrity judges. It's not a good thing.
No.
Then they end up going on Strictly Come Dancing and things.
Oh, you don't want that. I mean, I think that the fact that he's made very different decisions in two very high profile cases. I'd like to think that that's simply a manifestation of the impartiality of the law. Presumably, he's made these decisions on purely legal grounds, and he's not got an agenda here. And so, basically, he's simply pointing out what stands in the law and what falls, and is up to other people to make a convincing case.
Yes, and it's worth noting that while we may often think, you know, on these. Judgments and appeal hearings that are put through by a judge or a small panel of judges, that people go, oh, bloody judges, what do they know? That in fact, they're only reflecting on laws which are made by Parliament, our representatives.
Yeah.
So it's the law, if most of the time, I would say that if the judge comes out with some ruling which is surprising, shocking, wrong, boneheaded, whatever, it's probably not the judge that's wrong. It's probably the law that's fallible.
Yes. Well, it's either the law or the fact that, or the lawyers haven't done their job right. They haven't managed to make a case. And it's not a failure of a judge. I mean, obviously, judges are fallible. We all are. But I think this is a case in point. It just shows you that he's noticed that there are holes to pick in these arguments, and he's drawn the correct conclusions. I mean, he sounds like he's obviously very experienced in this area of the law anyway. So, you know.
But my point is that if government is having trouble with judges, okay, the judge has backed up. It's the road investment strategy in broad terms, but it's put the kibosh, at least for now, on the Stonehenge tunnel.
Yeah.
It's up to government, I think, to if it feel so minded, is to change the law. Now, government can't do it. It's got to put it through Parliament. The current government has a strong majority in Parliament, and if it feels that the law needs to change, it needs to get Parliament to scrutinise that properly and get it through. Although, obviously, it may well, if it changes the law so that any bypass can be built anywhere and the roads programme becomes hugely unpopular, of course it's going to be a vote loser for
sure. It is interesting to see how long this whole sort of Stonehenge business has been dragging out, because for as long as I can remember there have been proposals for bypasses, tunnels and various other mitigating schemes for Stonehenge, and I don't grasp the niceties of the situation. To me, it seems fairly straightforward. You dig a tunnel and you put the road in the tunnel, get the traffic out of the way, keep the traffic moving, and Bob's your uncle, you've got a solution. But it's clearly far more complicated than that. So I don't suppose, you know, that this is the last we'll hear of this. I mean, we're bound to see an alternative scheme proposed, aren't we, or a modified scheme?
I think so. I mean, you and I know that the A303... at Stonehenge and in other places is a problem that needs solving.
Yes. Now,
it may well be that we end up flying around on our personal hoverboards in 20 years' time and we don't need roads and the problem doesn't need solving, it just goes away because no one's driving on the A303. I don't think that's going to happen. But even if Stonehenge, the problem's not going to go away if it's not solved, but even if the tunnel project is completely abandoned and government just says, oh, well, to hell with it, we're not going to bother, fed up arguing, which I don't think will happen. It's not just the Stonehenge tunnel we're talking about in this context. There are various major projects that the Transport Action Network is campaigning against, including the Lower Thames Tunnel.
Yes.
Now, the Lower Thames Tunnel is a completely, from a transport point of view, a completely different issue, whereas the Stonehenge Tunnel is, the existing road is slow and chocker and a bottleneck, so let's improve that by sticking it underground and further away. The Lower Thames Tunnel is an additional crossing of the Thames, several miles away from the Dartford crossing,
where
there's a bridge and two tunnels currently. And what that will have will actually probably promote development in that area of the Thames estuary. Now, it has for a long time been government policy of both, well, ever since I think ever since Michael Heseltine was John Major's Environment Secretary and he came back, the whole Thames Gateway thing, and that was being supported by John Prescott and the current government, and I mean, the whole Thames Gateway area is meant to be and is being developed, but there's still huge opposition from, I think, mainly from local residents to the prospect of the Lower Thames crossing. And the government has been sent back to the drawing board on that project. We've talked about that before. It applied for a development consent from the planning inspector, and the planning inspector said, basically threw its homework back at it and slapped it around the head and said, this is rubbish, go back and, you know, you must do better, study harder. And so they've opened up public consultation again on slightly tweaked and revised plans. I mean, it's basically the same project, but they're trying to fill in the gaps for their planning application. So that is still very much alive and a very hot potato controversial issue that's being battled over.
Do you think that Stonehenge will be the same?
I imagine that they will look at the Stonehenge. Highways England will look at the Stonehenge and think, right, what can we learn from this? And the Department for Transport, what can we learn from this? How can we prevent when, as inevitable, if the planning inspectors, whether they say yay or nay to the Lower Thames crossing, doesn't matter because, as we've discovered, the Transport Secretary can still go ahead and approve a major scheme. So if a future Transport Secretary, because let's not pretend Grant Shapps is still going to be around by that time, they never last that long. If a future Transport Secretary says yes to the Lower Thames crossing, as sure as eggs is eggs, there will be a legal challenge to that.
Yeah.
Now, what that Transport Secretary will have to make sure is that whatever mistake Shapps made over Stonehenge, they're not making over the Lower Thames tunnel.
Yes.
So it's, you know, a learning process.
So are there any other big schemes which are, I mean, HS2 by any chance? I mean, that's always a hot potato.
We haven't even mentioned that, but clearly that doesn't seem to fit entirely well. And the argument with HS2 from the green perspective is it gets people out of their cars, but the numbers don't entirely bear that out. I mean, the whole net zero thing is clearly makes the HS2 argument vulnerable. I think the only thing is that at what point, I mean, we may have already passed it, at what point does HS2 become too far gone to cancel? It may well be that many people think it's already too far gone to cancel.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. I mean, obviously, there'd been absolutely no work on the Stonehenge Tunnel, the Lower Thames Crossing, so it's much easier to stop progress of a project that hasn't yet started. But as you say, HS2, no, it's a lot bigger and it's already started.
Well, millions have been spent on consultants, of course, but we don't seem to mind that. There just seems to be, you know, money on consultants. Bah.
Yes, but I think that once you start shifting earth and installing big structures, it's a psychological milestone apart from anything else, and that people feel that you can't really backtrack, leave things half built. You can always file away the documents somewhere and forget about them, but you can't really stop a bridge or a tunnel halfway through and then pretend it never happened.
It becomes forever a monument to your incompetence,
your failure.
Yes.
Yeah.
But the whole argument about the greenness of roads and road building and whether it breaches the Paris Agreement and all of these sort of things, there is a... What's the opposite of an elephant in the room?
if elephant outside the room.
Well, no, it's more of a beautiful bunch of flowers in the room or something. But something that's not going to cause damage. But and I've mentioned this before, the whole argument against how roads are bad and polluting and we can't build more roads because of nitrous oxide emissions and pollution is awful, is that allegedly we're all going to be driving electric cars with zero tailpipe emissions within not very many years at all. I mean, probably by the time the Stonehenge Tunnel is built, most of the vehicles going through it, if it ever gets built, most of the vehicles going through it will be either electric powered, battery powered, solar powered,
or
whatever.
Hydrogen, yeah.
So to construct the argument against roads based on pollution only has short-term validity, it seems to me.
I mean, there are other polluting aspects of road use. I mean, there's the noise, which I suppose is a lot less from an electric car compared to a diesel one, say. Particulates, I mean, rubber, that kind of thing. I know that's, it certainly weakens the environmental argument against roads, but I think a lot of people would still say that they're environmentally damaging to a lesser extent.
Do you think so?
Well, I certainly think that people would make that argument, yes. I know that the current argument against roads is that they are environmentally damaging from the global point of view, from the point of view of carbon emissions and global warming. I'm not sure that that was the argument with Twyford Down, for example. I think that was simply the fact that Twyford Down, you know, that cutting under the through the...
That's more like the Stonehenge. That's more like the Stonehenge situation.
Yeah, that's to do with, you know, despoiling the environment from a, well, an aesthetic point of view and a habitat point of view. You know, you're cutting a great big swathe through some chalk downland, you know, which has remained untouched for centuries, clearly gets people riled. And I think it's obviously the same with, slightly different with Stonehenge, because it's got this World Heritage status and all the rest of it. But I still think that if you start concreting over swathes of the countryside, it's the same with housing developments, it's the same with HS2, as we know. People get very upset when they see bits of unspoiled countryside being built on. So I think even if the environmental argument is weakened by the fact that cars are less polluting than they currently are, there'll still be a very strong lobby arguing against developments like this on the basis of countryside and habitat loss. So I think there'll always be there will always be opposition.
And there is, as I mentioned before, the idea of we don't really know with home working, with everyone, you know, zooming and not moving around so much, maybe what the traffic demand will be. And I don't know how traffic forecasters can begin to work out what future demand is going to be. In fact, if I read a traffic forecast, I'd just go, don't believe it. Might be right, but there can't be any science in it. It's like weather forecasting in the 1830s.
Yes, it's just guessing. It's just guesswork. Yeah. No, I agree. But I mean, what do you do? Just sit on your hands and wait until the fog clears and you know where you're going. You can't really do that. You've got to make an educated guess, I suppose, which is a bit frightening when you're talking about big infrastructure projects. Another story posted on the website this week shows that HS2 is making, I don't know if you call it a token gesture or if it's a real contribution to minimising its carbon emissions. Obviously, every time they do something which can be construed as being kind to the environment, they grab it with both hands. But there's a story, I think you posted it, or our colleague Lisa posted it yesterday, about the Skanska Costain Strabag joint venture on HS2 are going to be using a new 3D printed concrete technology. It's not just 3D printed concrete, which itself is novel enough, but this is graphene reinforced concrete. So really cutting edge stuff. And they are apparently, well, I'll read you a little bit of the story, which is the deployment of the on-site 3D reinforced concrete printing technology called Printfrastructure, which I think is a pretty clumsy name, but there you go, is intended to deliver environmental and cost benefits for Britain's new high-speed rail network. They reckon, according to HS2 Limited, they reckon that it could contribute to reduction in carbon emissions of up to 50%.
Well, here we go again. Hang on, here we go again. We were talking about this the other week, about HS2 going, we've got this great, fantastic new technology. It was in context of a new bridge design, wasn't it?
And so that's right.
It uses less material. And it's not, it's going to make things quicker or cheaper. It's not going to save us X amount of pounds. It's going to save X amount of carbons.
Yes, that's right.
I mean, if it's going to...
This is exactly the same thing.
If it's going to cost 8 times more, then maybe your carbons shouldn't be being saved in this particular regard. So presumably it's saving money as well, isn't it? They don't say.
It doesn't say.
Anyway, interrupt. Carry on. Tell us about this.
Well, Well, I don't. I've only, what I know is all that I've read on the website. So I'm probably as well informed as many of our readers. It's a 3D printed concrete technique developed by a company called Changemaker 3D, based in Worcestershire anyway. And I looked at their website and did a bit of research about them. Never heard of them before. They do sound like quite an interesting company. They've got an interesting sort of inclusivity ethos as well, which is beside the point in this terms. But they've developed this 3D printing technology for concrete structures. They've combined with, they've got together with a materials specialist called Versarion or Versarion. Again, I know nothing about them. I assume that they do graphene because that's their contribution. Graphene, which is this sort of carbon-based reinforcement on a molecular basis. I mean, they're talking about, you know, from what I know about graphene, it's incredibly light. It's got an incredible strength for its weight, but it's on a tiny, tiny scale. So you're not talking about carbon rods or even carbon fibers. You're talking about carbon atoms arranged in a certain way, and these are sort of woven into the concrete mix. I don't think there's any aggregate in there. I think it's basically just mortar. It's just fines and cement and this magic graphene, which they then squirt it onto a plate. I don't know what they do with it, but they print this stuff. So they're talking about using this for, I think it's the tunnel project. Yes, printing concrete with computer-operated robots will enable the joint venture to make structural elements on site instead of transporting them as precast slabs by road. So this is for bridges, tunnels, all the rest of it. It isn't specific about which components will be made using this technology. And one thing which made me a little bit confused was that there was absolutely no mention of how this technology had been developed, when it had been developed, how it had been trialled, because presumably if you're going to start using this on a project like HS2...
I've got the story in front of me, and the very last sentence, because you read this story, and I've also read the press release which is based on the HS2 put out, and it's exactly the same thing. Yes. It's full of, you know, it's this interesting, fascinating, potentially game-changing technology and so on and so forth. Last sentence. Proof of concept trials are due to begin in spring 2022. In other words, we're still 9 months away from seeing if it works or not.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. And yet, if you go to the top of the story, you know, they're going to be using this stuff. So it's almost as if you get the impression this is almost like a proven technology. You know, we'll pioneer the use of graphene-reinforced 3D printed concrete.
That's accurate. I mean, that's an absolutely accurate report. I mean, they are pioneering it. It's not being used for, and they're at the cutting-edge front end. It's just that we're not quite as close to it as perhaps HS2 Limited would like us to believe.
Have us believe, yeah. Interesting idea. I don't doubt that for a minute.
I have a problem though with the use of the term 3D printing when it comes to concrete, because 3D printing, when we've seen it on telly or whatever, it does seem incredibly whizzy and high tech. But essentially, 3D printing with concrete is just pouring it out of a thin tube, isn't it?
Yes.
It's just like a concrete pour, except you're directing it a bit more precisely.
That's a good point, because of course, and there is a there's an alternative term, because I'm uncomfortable with
additive
the term,
manufacturing.
3D printing. Additive manufacturing, which sounds to me gives you a better idea of what's actually going on here. I mean, the idea of it being like it operates like a printer, like a modern an inkjet printer. That's two dimensional. This is three dimensional. So I can see why it's been it's been described as that, but I think that
do you remember the other week we were talking about the building that Wilmot Dixon job, which is not Colston Hall anymore, the Bristol
Bristol Beacon
and you were explaining how amongst the various unexpected items in the bagging area that emerged as they were doing it, was that the pillars within the building, which is what, Victorian or something, that they thought would be solid, they found they were hollow, and therefore they needed to fill them up with concrete, but they couldn't do it all in one because it would blow the brickwork of the pillars.
Yes.
Therefore, they poured it in a bit at a time. Well, isn't that 3D printing? Isn't that additive manufacturing?
I suppose so. The difference is, of course, you've got a sort of permanent formwork caused created by the brickwork. I mean, there must be. I suppose I want to look into this, because additive manufacturing or 3D printing with concrete. We all know what concrete looks like when it's poured. It's liquid, basically. It's like very runny custard, and it's not self-supporting. You need formwork. And you pour it in and you vibrate it, get all the bubbles out, and it sets nice and hard, and you've got your concrete. But this stuff, clearly, it's designed so that the actual material itself will go off very quickly, because I mean you couldn't just squirt this stuff out into a predetermined pattern. It would just slump all over the floor if it was like normal concrete.
But you can make concrete as dry or wet as you like, and you can make it like icing sugar that you do out of a bag, that, you know, on those Mary Berry programs, you squirt out of a bag and ice a cake.
That's probably what they're doing. That's more like it. Yeah, there is a photograph actually on the website, which I noticed is also on the Changemaker 3D website. So they probably supplied it, showing. I don't know what it is. It seems to be some sort of curved component comprising two outer walls, if you like, with a sort of a zigzag reinforcing structure inside. And the outside edges look quite smooth, sharp edges, and very straight, whereas the zigzag thing really does look like it's come out of a piping bag. It really does look like icing on a cake. I don't know. I wouldn't have thought you would be able to get particularly close tolerances with this technology. And I might be wrong, but I wouldn't have thought you could get a sharp edge, for example. You are depositing a semi-solid material on top of something else. And surely you're not going to get a really nice smooth finish that you would do with something which had been poured into some shuttering.
But part of the hype of 3D printing is the whole automation and robot-y thing about it.
So
as you've got your icing bag going round, pouring on the next layer, presumably you could just have a robot arm coming along with a spatula and smoothing
it off. Troweling it. Yes, I suppose you could. Yeah, I don't see why not. Maybe that's what they're doing. The picture which I mentioned isn't big enough or detailed enough to actually show you what the finish is like, but I there must be ways of making it nice and smooth. I would love to know what sort of components they're planning to make with this technology. They say that one of the advantages, of course, is that you can set up this printer, or whatever you want to call it, on site. And actually make things on site instead of having to make them off site and deliver them.
You mean you can set up a concrete fabrication plant on site? Everyone does that, don't they? Well, lots of people do that.
Well, I suppose, yes, they do. I mean, a lot of precast concrete units are made just like any modern method of construction, made in factory conditions off site and delivered just in time for installation. That's one of the benefits of precast concrete, of course, is that you can do that. This seems to be going against the grain in a way, in that it's taking an off site technology and bringing it on site. But there are advantages in that, because it means less transport. I suppose you've got to get your raw materials to site, but it does mean that there are fewer lorry movements, I imagine. Well, I don't know. There have been technologies already that can 3D print concrete structures. We've seen them. I think there's an Australian company that has been building houses using a similar technology to this. Whether or not they do that on a commercial basis, I'm not quite sure. So this isn't... You know, the additive manufacturing side of this isn't completely new, because other people have certainly been doing it before. I think it's the idea that they're using graphene to reinforce the concrete, which is the interesting thing. That's the bit which I find fascinating, because graphene is such a it's on a completely different scale to everything else. It's on the atomic scale, and it's difficult to know how that can be used to lend strength to a structure. But I don't know. Maybe there's a video somewhere we can watch.
You mentioned Australian 3D printing. There was actually, we had a piece on the website last week. Again, Lisa ran this while I was away. Perry has used 3D printing to create a house that's now ready for occupancy in North Rhine-Westphalia, a town called Beckham. It looks quite small, but rather quaint, actually. I don't normally like these grand design type houses. I'm a bit conservative when I come to my architectural taste, but this is rather nice. And the finish given of it, it's rounded edges, and it has that plasticine-y surface that you tend to associate with 3D printing, as each little layer is added on top of the other. A nice texture to it.
I suppose it actually does behove Perry to get into this technology fairly quickly, because they represent the old technology, don't they? They're manufacturers of shuttering and formwork, and I suppose that's the industry, or the sector of the industry, that's being threatened by the advent of additive manufacturing.
Yes, absolutely. So, absolutely.
It makes sense for them to
pay the shuttering here, I imagine.
No, indeed, no, quite. But I hadn't seen that story. I will look at it. But yes, maybe we'll just have to get used to buildings and structures that look a little bit sort of blobby now, because if they're going to be using this technology and they haven't got the sharp edges and the flat surfaces.
I was hanging harsh on this picture. I wouldn't call it blobby. I would call it...
I haven't seen it yet, actually.
I'd call it elegant.
I'll check it out.
Well, the headline, the headline you're looking for is Germany's first 3D printed house opens. I'm not so sure about the inside, because it's got the same same finished inside as outside, as of these your McLeod chappies houses tend to have. I think I'd like a smoother finish inside.
Yes, I suppose the guys can go in there with some plaster in their trowels and make it all nice and smooth. That's not really a problem, is it? Because I mean, if you build a traditional house with brick and block, you're not, well, I suppose you could, if you're a designer, you might want to leave your blocks exposed for aesthetic reasons. But most of the time you have it nicely plastered inside, don't you? So I found the story, and it does look rather nice, actually. I quite like the look of that.
Garden needs some work.
Yeah, I don't think the focus is on the garden. The texture created by the 3D printing, those layers, they do sort of lend quite an interesting texture to the outside anyway. So it can work. It's not, and as you say, they've got rounded edges, rounded corners.
But I wonder how it weathers, whether algae, moss or dirt and grime will find the little crevices to get into and be hard to clean out.
Yeah, possibly. But then they'll probably claim that was the whole idea in the first place.
Character forming, yes.
Yeah, it's like the 1960s brutalist concrete structures, like the South Bank in London and other things like that. People said, look how dirty they are, these black streaks running down them. And the architect turned around and said, oh, no, it's supposed to look like that. That was, that was the original intention. I don't know how true that is. But anyway, so far it looks like a nice building anyway. Certainly different from the normal sort of run-of-the-mill type house. So there we are. Have we reached a
natural
conclusion? I think we have, haven't we?
Yeah, I think we've run out of topics for today, haven't we, David?
I think so.
But for another week, thank you everyone for listening to Reconstruction. For another week, this is myself, Philip Bishop, and him, David Taylor, saying thank you very much and goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.